is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health, your emotional, spiritual, mental well-being, and really just getting the knowledge so you find your way, the best way for you in this journey through life. And thanks for being with me today. It's always a fun time to have these great conversations and to know that we're all learning together. And for those of you who may be listening for the very first time, I hope you'll come visit me on my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. And you can also go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com. And either place, you'll be able to get the archived shows that I do on a weekly basis. Actually, I have two shows on Progressive Radio Network. So there is this one, What Women Must Know, and then I have a show every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time called The Love Code. And if you like me over on my Facebook page or sign up to my website, you will get both of those shows sent to you or posted, and you won't be able to miss out on some great conversations. So here is another conversation coming your way. We're going to be exploring what to do when you lose yourself in someone else. So that may ring some bells for some of you, probably for lots of you. We're going to be exploring how to really support your relationships without losing yourself. And my guest today is Nancy L. Johnston, who is a licensed professional counselor and licensed substance abuse treatment practitioner in private practice in Lexington, Virginia, treating adolescents and adults. She is a diplomat and a clinical mental health specialist in substance abuse and co-occurring disorder counseling through the American Mental Health Counselors Association, and a master addiction counselor. And she is the author of a brand new book that's just coming out called Disentangle: What to Do When You Lose Yourself in Someone Else. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Nancy to the show today. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for the invite.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us today and your busy schedule. I know you really have a very full-on practice, so it's great that we've taken a little time to get you to be on the show and share this topic, because it's a really interesting topic. Many years ago, I actually was a practicing psychotherapist, and I focused a lot of my time and learning on relationships. So it's a fascinating area. I did it because I wanted to be more resourceful in my own relationship, as most of us go into this field for ourselves. But it also was so enlightening and really helping people to find a path to connect with themselves, not lose themselves. So let's talk about that. So what do you mean? And by the way, congratulations on your book that's just being launched, and it's very exciting, which is, again, Disentangle: When You've Lost Yourself in Someone Else. I think that's a wonderful birthing process that's happening this week. So, again, congratulations. Mm-hmm. Nancy, so let's talk about losing ourselves in someone else. What does that mean?
Sure. Yes, well, I'll give you a little background, Cheryl, on how this work in this book has evolved in general, and then over time we can pick back through that. The work in this book goes back about 25 years, and that would be in the mid-1990s. And at that time, for both personal and professional reasons, I started tuning into this concept of loss of self in someone else. I had started to attend a fellowship for family members of alcoholism in an effort to restore myself, and that's language I use now more than I understood then. And so what I'm saying is I started noticing this issue of loss of self in others through alcoholic family systems. And nowadays we would say it's a very common phenomenon in any family system where addiction may be present. But what happened as I was starting to tune into both the real experience of loss of self and the clinical one, a client walked out, was leaving my office one day, and she said, "Nancy, I understand what you mean about getting some emotional distance from my husband." She said, "But how do you do that?" And Cheryl, I thought it was just a fabulous moment and question, because we can throw out these ideas of, oh, we'll just say no, or don't take it personal, or, oh, don't react to that. But as we, and I'm going to pick up your language already, as we are finding our way, those are difficult skills to really absorb and learn how to do. And so I tried to respond to her. I did respond to her by a quick jotted down list of about six different ideas about how do we do this emotional balance. Now I speak out of it as emotional balancing myself. As that clinical day went on in private practice, I noticed a theme of how often people needed this type of information, and the theme of disconnecting from self and focusing on what other people need from us. It was an in-law situation. There was a work situation. And what I started to see, not just that day, but over the next year or so, was that we get so focused on what the needs of other people or accommodating those or trying to help someone be pleased by us or like us, that in that very behavior, we lose our connection with ourself. So briefly, that little list became a handout, became groups, became a self-published book. Then Central Recovery Press picked it up in 2011. And what is launched this week is the second edition of it by Central Recovery Press. So it's just an ever-evolving piece of work.
Well, good for you. And, you know, one query and one conversation can lead to, well,
isn't it something?
Mm-hmm. a whole new direction in life, really, and a great awakening.
Yes.
So what, we obviously you deal with a lot of addiction, and I think we really need to expand that definition. We often think of addiction related to alcohol or maybe some substance abuse, but I know in my work, addiction has a much greater meaning and mm-hmm. dynamic that probably most people are dealing with, whether they are aware of it or not. So can we explore what is meant by an addictive pattern or a system that is operating dysfunctionally?
Right. So one of the things, the hallmarks for me of an addiction would be the individual's inability to control their use of fill in the blank, Cheryl, okay? That certainly is one of the ways that we define the substance addiction, is the inability, say, to not drink, even though they've said they aren't going to do that. But any we would call loss of control over use. So, you know, if we're talking about spending, say, and we really cannot control our spending, that is a hallmark of something to pay attention to. An addicted system also is characterized by tolerance is a word, where it just takes more and more engagement to get the same effect or high, or I was listening to an excellent webinar the other day, infatuation would be the emotional experience we're talking about. So loss of control over use, a building of tolerance, and continued use of whatever, despite negative effects on someone's life. I'll stop there right now and see what you might want to do with those. But those are all very practical, hands-on ways to help a person look at what may be going on.
So one of the thoughts I had as you were talking, what are some ahas that you may have for us? You know, for so many people, they are brought up in family systems, which are repeated, but they seem like normal, right? So that's just
yes.
the way it is, and these are just
mm-hmm.
the beliefs I have, and this is just what I have to expect. What are some of the insights that you have that could be aha moments for people listening that makes them realize that there is a pattern operating in their lives that does not support their highest expression?
Right. So I would say those ahas, let's take it, well, they're going to be a combination of listening to our thoughts, our feelings, our body, and our spirit, Cheryl. So let me be very concrete. So if I am finding that I am very resentful, that would be a classic program type word. If I am resentful, I'm the one, let's reel it back to me as the one who loses myself in someone else. If I am starting to feel really resentful of everything that I'm doing for someone else or other people, that is my moment not to blast them, but to let it be my aha moment, to use your language, to wake up, to become aware that I am out of balance in that moment, and to pause and to step back and to start listening to, wait a minute, you know, I'm resentful, and am I doing something? Did they ask me to do it? Did I volunteer to do it? Did I volunteer to do it when I don't have any time to do it? Am I extending myself past my resources? I could give an hour lecture on this particular resentment moment. I would say other mind-body-feeling things would be if we're exhausted and really feel like at the end of the day that someone said to me years ago, where was I in the formula? All of a sudden, what was on my little to-do list for the day, I didn't even revisit it because I lived my life in a way that swept me away to other people's lists and things that I thought were important, but I got away from my list, and now I'm super exhausted and don't have time to do the things that I do. I would say any type of strong emotions or body. The body really does tell us. It may not be able to be specific, but it can tell us if our back is aching or our jaw is tight or any number, if our fists are grabbed, and we want to notice that and gently find time and space to sort and listen to what's going on within. That's the beginning. Then there are things to do. But those are the aha moments.
So it would be accurate to say, Nessie, wouldn't it, if you find yourself in a repetitive pattern or behavior, if you're finding yourself repeatedly feeling resentful towards situations, if you are finding yourself always feeling exhausted because you just extend yourself beyond what you really want to do, if you're feeling that you are always in power struggles in relationships, and you know, if you see patterns going on, this is a pretty big signal. That's the awareness. That's the wake-up call that there
is. It is, Cheryl. And I'm jumping in because there's an important moment in what you're saying, and then we'll go where your question goes. This is this aha moment. It's beautiful you're calling it, because this is the moment where we can either fall to the pattern again, which is to be upset with other people because they are asking of us, you know, too much, or not responding to us, we can keep that external focus. This aha moment wakes us up, and it is then the invitation not to be hard on ourselves. I'm very compassionate, but to say, wait a minute, let me shift this focus to my internal self and see what I'm doing and where I have some control in my life that could help me.
So when we see patterns come up, especially if it happens more than once, you know it's a pattern. If you are reactive to someone more than once,
yes,
if you have a strong emotion more than once, we can see it's a pattern. To really get the healing from this moment, because, I mean, we've all been in those situations. I certainly have. I've noticed where I would keep running, bumping, I would say, into patterns that were not comfortable, that caused some degree of discomfort emotionally, physically. It's the beginning of a journey of really becoming more responsible, I would say, or you could say waking up or being empowered, because the journey here, and I'm sure this is what you do in your work, because it's just that's what you do is working in your field to support people and taking responsibility for their lives. We have to go deeper and understand we are operating with a program that was most likely 99% of the time set up early in our life, and it is a program that is demanding our attention for healing and transformation so we could step out of programmed responses and have a greater freedom to live our life.
Well put. Yes. I'm with you.
Right? So can we talk, can we drill down a little deeper, because this is so important. This is the only way out of suffering. And suffering in relationships, suffering with our own sense of self, suffering in, you know, with our body. We have to go deeper. We have to enter a place where we really examine and take responsibility of the models of the world that we lived with, that we've been kind of introduced to, that we are continuing in a way that it was never productive in the first place, and we've just kind of been programmed that way. What is really going on when you work with people? What are you wanting people to discover to truly be able to heal? Because it's not about stopping a pattern; it's about healing something, a wound deep within ourselves.
Yes, and this is second edition is greatly expanded in this direction, Cheryl, of looking at what about us has these patterns. I had it some in the first edition, but as I've worked with people, I feel like it is a really important area. So in the book, there are four areas of work. I'll just say them so the listeners. It's facing illusions, which is seeing the reality of things. Detaching, which is becoming responsive and not reactive. Setting healthy boundaries and spirituality. The detaching section is where I invite the reader to go to do the digging down. We want to spend some time understanding what has us, again, to use your language, in these patterns. And to do that, I have an illustration of three concentric circles. In the center is the individual who I am. And that there's, we can't really, nature and nurture blur in together as we know. But the basic core who I may be basically a kind person, a considerate person, a patient person. Outside, the second ring around that is the family system in which we grew up. And the third ring is the social cultural environment in which the family was, in which the whole family system was situated. All of those three areas are areas we can look into to understand why I, Nancy, have a pattern of becoming insecure and worried about how somebody else is feeling about me or whether I have done enough. So that's the general picture. Part of the work I do is to honor our basic nature. We haven't brought in the word codependent, but I am going to bring it in here, Cheryl. I don't dodge the word, but I feel like one of the essences of what it is this loss of self. That's a very short version of a lot of thinking. And I think that we each carry characteristics that I would put on a continuum. And at one end, if I am a fixer, a helper, on one end of the continuum, there's nothing wrong with that. But if I carry it down too far and lose myself in the process of that specific behavior, then it has become a problem for me. So when we go back to looking at this image of digging deeper and the family, the individual, I want to understand who I am and basically. And then the whole family system piece opens up many wonderful opportunities. And I'll throw an assortment of ideas out, and you can say where it would be useful to go. We can look at roles we played in our family system that were functional then, but that have us locked into them as adults and really keep those patterns going. We can look at family rules that were in place, like don't trust or don't talk or don't speak. Claudia Black's work is who I'm citing here. Looking at those family roles, family rules, and seeing their effect on us and inviting us to change, to see what we would like to change. The third area that I've gotten particularly interested in over these, since the first edition, is the attachment theory parts, where we are looking at our basic, are we insecurely or securely attached? And that does go back to our foundational relationships with parents. Trauma is also in this list of things that the individual can be invited to look into. Again, it's just like you said, to understand the stuckness and the patterns. So I'll leave those words there and let you pick from that where it would be good. Yeah, lots of family dynamics and ways to look at it.
Well, yeah, so much to be said. You know, I think the journey of healing where we can step out of these repetitive patterns, and the reason why we want to have a look at these repetitive patterns because they are a source of such frustration and such stress. So we can never really get our needs met. We can never really be heard. We can't really get the love we want. We get stuck in anger or resentment or feeling victimized, but not ever really stepping out of that role, having a strategy to not be a victim. I mean, these are patterns that are so prevalent that just initiate such a stress response within us that they ultimately will lead to some sort of physical manifestation,
mm-hmm.
which is
mm-hmm.
why this is critical work. We have to unravel the mystery of who we are and why we find ourselves continuing to do the same thing or be in the situations that create such levels of unmet needs and frustrations. So let's talk about that process, because obviously the first step, and before we go there, Nancy, maybe give us some examples, because I think it's really powerful when you tell some stories of some of your experiences with clients that may illustrate some of these points.
Right. So let's work with Sharon Wegscheider Cruz's family roles. Those would be hero, scapegoat, lost child, and mascot. And so if I have a client who has been the hero in the family system, them coming to understand that that role is I always have to do everything right, and I have to keep everybody happy, and I have to make sure that I'm also a star sometimes. I'm the best in the class, or I want to make my family proud. And so that would be, often I am running into a client who wants to, I'm going to construct a hypothetical case. Let's say a client is wanting to not work full time anymore, and they can financially afford to do that. But they feel like if they were to, and they're exhausted, and their whole being needs to, and they're able with their job, it's only up to the individual about whether they're going to choose to take this part to go half-time or not. The pattern that they have probably been in, we look and we find that their pattern is this hero pattern, which is, no, I must tough on, I must do this, I must perform, and to do anything less than work full time would be not being in the hero role. And so the healing is the person noticing that, one, that's the role, and two, they need helping them find a willingness. That's such an important word in whether it's addiction or this word, to shift out of that role, to say, you know what, it won't look great on my resume, but I just really, my whole body, my whole spirit says that I really need to be stepping back and do work half-time for a while. They have to be willing to make that change. Then there's a bunch of skill sets in order to be able to do that. And we want to help them build in self-talk that reassures them, oh, I know why I'm doing this. My body and spirit are tired. I know I'm used to being the hero. See, that's where they tap back into the primary pattern. And at the same time, I want to be the lost child for a while. I want to have time in my day where I can go in my room and read. I want to have time in my day where everyone else is off doing their own things and I don't have to be on my game 100%.
Right. So that's one good example.
Right.
I mean, there's so many patterns. I mean, you know, this is a journey really of through life of really coming to understand yourself. I mean, most of us, if we don't have some degree of self-awareness, if we haven't looked inside, if we haven't investigated and recognized patterns that are not supportive of us, that they disconnect us, we can't really live a fulfilled life. And that connects us back to the spiritual journey that we are all on. Because therapy and self-awareness is really part of this spiritual awakening where we can step out of patterns and really step into a more of our own inner authority or a connection to a greater place of wisdom within ourselves. Does that make sense to you?
It sure does. No, it sure does. I can give you another example that pulls from attachment theory if you would like that, Cheryl. I'll
sure.
take your direction here. So attachment theory is interested in, I'm going to speak very simply from the work of John Bowlby, where as a very young child, we learned to, because of the way our primary caregiver was with us, we learned to watch them and respond to them to do what is they needed or wanted or what we thought would give us the love and reassurance that we wanted, that they wanted. And in the doing of that, it establishes within the person an insecure attachment. A secure attachment comes when the infant and child experience the parent being really tuned into them. Attuned is a word that is used, and able to reflect to the child, to the infant, who they are. So, again, an insecure client might present as always insecure, anxious. Let's say they are in a relationship with someone who is not very attentive, or not attentive at the level that the person would like them to be. They don't. My client will make 3 phone calls or texts for every one that they get back, and the insecure part of them continues to drive. There's the pattern, the approval seeking, the love seeking, the attention seeking, and it's by my client, with help, being able to stop and look at the nature of their insecure attachment. Pursuing a relationship, if you're an insecure person, pursuing a relationship with the hopes that that relationship will help to make us more secure is not a guaranteed thing. That we could go several ways on that, but it's not a guaranteed thing. And so I want to help the client who's insecurely pursuing this other person to pause and gently look at this pattern of external seeking. And part of it in this case with attachment issues is the grief, going through grief. Cheryl, we couldn't talk about this deeper work without bringing in the word grief for what we didn't get, or how we wish things had been, not in a blaming way, but in just a realizing what our experience was. And in that grieving, some of the freedom to start being secure within ourselves is the path that we're headed there, and being able to reassure ourselves and self-soothe ourselves in the face of when that insecurity starts coming forward.
So many examples, and we can just see how these patterns of unmet needs, of programming of our families, you know, we're looking at some therapies. We can even go back to past generations, past ancestors, past lives. But here's my question. What is it that you have found to be the most effective modality and strategy for creating permanent lasting change?
Well, my style is that to really, truly meet the person, to really be present with them and to attune to them. I'm going to use some language from attachment theory, to really be making sure that they feel heard and noticed and understood. And I do believe that with that strength of the relationship with the person, that it helps them to unlock lots of wonderful stuff that is within them already.
You know, I have done some studying with a wonderful man named Harville Hendrix. You probably know who Harville is.
Yes, yes.
And he is best known for his book, first book is Getting the Love You Want, and he's written lots of books after that. And I've had him on my program before, and I've attended some workshops with him. I actually love the work of Harville Hendrix. And one of the things that always fascinated me, because Harville Hendrix has always been, he's been working with couples and working in relationships, and then he has expanded and has worked with children and probably everybody one form or another, because the patterns that we have set up from our family dynamics get played out in all areas of our life. So you see them at work, you see them, whatever organization you may be in, you see all those family members seem to show up in another form,
yeah.
But the same
right.
dynamics,
well, no, that's,
right?
Yeah, that's the family roles, yes,
yes,
that's
yes,
in my
right?
field, right, yes.
So what? But has always fascinated me with what Harville Hendrix has said, and what really resonated with me, and the purpose of his work. So the purpose of his work. I mean, I shouldn't assume I know the purpose of his work, but what he was saying was one of his outcomes he's going for is that when people can be present and be heard and just be in a conversation where with another person where they the other person just acknowledges what they said, doesn't try to change them, doesn't question them, just, you know, responds like, okay, I hear you, this is what you just said, did I get that right, okay. You don't have to agree, but you just allow that person to be heard, which is a really novel experience for most of us, that there is a profound change that happens in the brain. And we step out of the limbic, reptilian, reactive stress response part of the brain, go into the frontal lobe, the frontal lobe would be the place where you can be more objective, where you can be more compassionate, where you can operate from a different way than you have as a reactive brain. And his work, as he said, was really to give people these new experiences of being safe in the world, of being heard, of being validated, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is actually changing our brain. And mm-hmm. what he was saying, the bigger picture for his work, and there are many people doing powerful work, but that's someone I've been exposed to, the bigger purpose for what he does is to create peace in the world. And to me, that is so profound, because we can only truly have peace in this world. It's not by treaties, and it's not by, you know, negotiating. Ultimately, the only way we can have true peace in the world is when people are healing their wounded selves, and the part that operates out of that limbic system, that reptilian, reactive, fear-based part of our brain or consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I agree. Yes.
Yeah, so what are your thoughts about that, Nancy?
Oh, well, that's, I agree completely. That's very, echoes what I was saying about my intent is to, whether I'm in a workshop or whether I am in a retreat or just in my therapy office, is to absolutely, and I follow the neuroscience too. I even the new edition, the second edition, it helps the lay reader into some of that neuroscience that we were talking about. But I think that everything he said is what I agree with. And I can tell when I'm losing, when I, Nancy Johnston, am either rushing with a client and either I've taken one jump ahead and I'm not with my client anymore, and the whole energy and the flow, I'm very tuned into that, is altered by that. Let's say, for example, a person says, I wish I could bring up a quick example, but let's say they were wanting to get a new computer. No, that's not a good example. They wanted to ask their best friend for some help. Okay. So what happens is I could, if I'm not careful, stay in what I call, Cheryl, a problem-solving mode. Okay, well, that's a great idea. So how are we going to ask your friend? What's a good time of the day? What's the best form of communication? Now, let me be clear, we can do that. But I can feel in the room if they're not, if I jump to another track called problem solving. And I find that and I realize, oh, I want to hear more from them about how they feel about asking for help at all and how they feel about this idea that they just came up with and what's going on with them as they imagine doing that. And all of a sudden, it's really rich, meaningful work. Because that is that's where the deeper work is. It's not the problem-solving side of things. And I find, you know, let's say that they hate asking for help, that their patterns are to never ask for help. And so we can work with that.
So do you do just a counseling model, or do you work with techniques that actually go in and create change working with modalities that actually are rewiring the brain?
Well, I actually don't quite know how to answer that question. I would say that, see, I think that mindfulness itself rewires the brain. Well, we know that. I mean, that's not hypothetical. So one of the strategies that I've been a student of the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn since, the whole time this book has been going on. So I do think that conscious breathing and mindful breathing, and I will stop in a session sometimes. Usually it's if the client asks. Sometimes they'll arrive and they'll say, can we take 10 minutes to just breathe? And what I know we're doing is shifting that neurobiology. We are quieting the sympathetic nervous system that has the adrenaline and the cortisol running. And as they've either rushed to the office or very often have had some issue that's upset them just before they have come into the office. So neurobiologically, we certainly are using mindful breath and occasionally some mindful stretching. Certainly in my retreats, we do mindful stretching more easily than in the office. And so that's certainly, mindfulness is certainly one of the specific things that that I will use. I also do like, it's interesting, I do like, well, let's just stay with the neurobiology to answer your question as best I can. I'm also intrigued with Rick Hansen's work, Buddha's Brain and Hardwiring Happiness. And he, of course, uses mindfulness a great deal. But I think an important piece that I have from him is, he calls it heal, have a positive experience, enrich it, absorb it, and then link it. Well, I'm not going to teach all of that. But we very often, in terms of rewiring, do not let something positive seep in enough. And the neuroscientists are telling us that we can, it's just what you were saying with Harville Hendrix, that we really can improve our neural pathways if we will let the good stay with us. So if I say that you look really great in that color, and we have an immediate way that we deflect that, I've had this blouse since, you know, I was 20 years ago, and we have not let that compliment in. And that's something I've been doing more and more for myself with the internal stuff, is trying to let the good seep in, not letting judgment on my part or self-consciousness, trying to be very aware of those as they show up, and rather letting the positivity have its place and help with the rewiring.
So what would you offer my listeners today, some practical strategies or insights? Where can they begin to take back to themselves and you know, dissolve, I would say, the patterns, the energies that have kept them in frustrating or unfulfilling dynamics, whatever that may be? What would be some practical tools you would suggest for people?
Well, that takes me back to commenting on the four areas of work in the book itself. facing illusions of seeing the reality of things, detaching boundaries and spirituality. So I'll comment briefly on each of those. The first one about facing illusions is for us to, as we are getting to know our patterns, to use that language, is to allow ourselves, and here comes the grief process again, to see the reality of things, of the other person, of how we are, how our situation may be. We have an assortment of ways of defending, as we know, against seeing those. We have hope of things changing. We keep thinking that if we did something different, things would change. So helping ourselves see that, you know, we've loaned money to our adult child 3 times and it's a loan and they never pay us back and we ask for them to pay us back and they never pay us back. And so we want to see and face that reality. So the next time they pay us back, we may say, I can't pay you. I'm sorry. The next time they ask us to give money, we might say, well, I'm sorry, I'm not able to do that. We need to talk about paying me back for the other money. So seeing the truths in there is very important. In the detaching section, I would say we've covered a lot that's in there about shifting from being reactive to being responsive. Reactive keeps us in our patterns that you're speaking of. And it's only by stopping and pausing ourselves and then thinking, what is it that I really do want to say? What is it that I really am feeling? What is true for me? And then being able to move into that. So if somebody has said, are you able to keep my kids this on Saturday? My husband and I have a plan to go somewhere. And we had planned something special for ourselves that day. Now I'm getting into the boundaries. I say to everybody, don't say yes or no right on the spot. Stop, pause, step back. Say, let me think about that. I'll get back with you. And in the letting and in the stepping back, then we can, now I'll talk to boundaries. Now we think, I really want to help them out. And I really wanted the day to myself. So how do we sort through that with ourselves? And I might decide, oh, I really terribly need to have some time for myself. And I don't know, Cheryl, I'm not going to construct the whole thing. We could go back and forth with a compromise. But mainly I'm not just saying, sure, I'll be glad to do that. And then they arrive on Saturday morning to be dropped off, here comes the other word we talked about. I'm resentful and I'm happy that I've done this and this is what my whole day is. I want to have stopped first and given myself, you know, deep, serious consideration and then figured out what is, and we, all of us therapists talk about, what is my I statement? I want what, you know, I can do that for 2 hours and that's what I can offer you. If that can help you, let me know. That might be a formulated I statement. And the fourth area is spirituality. And it's that section, Cheryl, is very influenced by learning to live the serenity prayer. And that is sorting what I can and cannot control, acting on what I can, letting go, using my spirituality to help me let go of what I cannot control. And this is a super important area. Because if we go back to my word about entanglements, often entanglements are about me trying to control something that I really do not have in my control. And my healing is to start noticing that pattern, perhaps, and shift it because there's plenty I can control. Very often, very often I say this in a somewhat light way, very often what I'm trying to do is control what I cannot, which is called the other person. And I'm not controlling what I can, which is myself.
Well, ultimately, that's what mastery is all about. And, you know, I think the you know, you have many skills, and obviously have dedicated yourself to this work, and it gives you many facets in order to reflect back to people, which what a good counselor does. It's a way to be a mirror, so to speak, to allow people to have more insight into themselves, to be heard, to begin to be more introspective, to identify and observe themselves and the behaviors that they've been operating in their lives. And I also like to combine that, as you were saying, with the spiritual, with the mindful work. You know, there's so much research that shows that mindfulness changes the brain, that heart math changes your brain. And ultimately, if we're going to step out of patterns, Nancy, I think you have to change your brain, because mm-hmm. what wires together, fires together, and
mm-hmm,
there's only
mm-hmm.
so much we can change by talking, but there is so much more profound transformations that can occur when we work with the techniques that actually are getting into the rewiring of our brain. Because when you rewire your brain, you see the world differently, you have different behaviors, you have different responses. That is how ultimately you step out of the pattern. I think you have to come to some level of self-awareness, which is where the counseling role is really important, to just reflect and to, you know, explore oneself. And then you have to put these techniques in place if you really want to rewire your brain, because you see the world differently when you rewire your brain. And that's, in my experience, the way to step out of pain and suffering and trauma.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yes, and again, that's what the inclusion, like I said earlier, of the neuroscience pieces in the second edition is one of the significant additions to from 2011 to the edition of 2020 now, and I agree very much with you, and I'm glad. Usually what I'm trying to do is to teach it and impart it in a way, and Cheryl, I don't know if you're sitting there with the book at your fingertips or not.
Yes, I am.
If you go to the back, Appendix D, and again, the listeners, I can't explain this, but it's the diagram that's here is one that I created. I was speaking to a weekend retreat of varied sources of people, and I was wanting to know the listeners. It's entitled "Illustration of Neurobiology and Self," and it was a very simple but straightforward way of trying to teach what is going on in our neurobiology, and it basically is calling our reactive system our hot water heater, and us learning to draw out of our responsive, calm lake faucet instead of our hot water heater faucet. And yes, Cheryl, the more we work with things that help to change that wiring, the more we can control that faucet in that diagram.
Yeah, and you know, then we see possibilities that we didn't see before. We see options and behaviors that we didn't know that even existed, which is where it gets exciting, because then we find the answers we're looking for. And you know, Nancy, this has been such a great conversation. I just want to let people know that your book, the second and updated and revised and
Ackerbach
with more possibilities, version of Disentangle has just been released, and the full title is When You've Lost Yourself and Someone Else. Disentangle When You've Lost Yourself and Someone Else, which has some great information, some great strategies. It will be a guide for people who are ready to make some changes and create more of the responses, situations that are more gratifying, how to step out of the past and into new possibilities. So this is an exciting new book, and I want to congratulate you. And let's let people know where they can go and find more about you and your work. Do you do virtual counseling now, Nancy?
I do now, yes, and I'm laughing because I did not before March 16th, and now I do. Now I do. I should be clear. I am not taking new private clients. If people are interested in workshops or my weekend retreats, go to my website at nancyljohnston.com, and that is a form that I continue to expand. And yes, we're in a pandemic and we're not doing those things right now. I am hopeful one day I will return to that work.
I'm sure you will. All things shall pass.
I agree. I'll let that good seep in. There it is. It'll pass.
Why not? It doesn't cost anymore. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today, Nancy. Again, congratulations with the release of the updated version of your book, Disentangle. People can learn more about you and your work at Nancy L. Johnston. That's with a S-T-O-N at the
yes,
end.
Yes, thank you.
And just wishing you the greatest success in all that you do. Thanks for being with us today and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you, Cheryl.
And to all my listeners, thank you for joining me for another opportunity to have some wonderful, thought-provoking conversation. And remember, I'm here every Thursday. Go to What Women Must Know or Dr. Cheryl Selman so you can get all of the archive shows. And until next week, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.